Liberal halvtime. En podcast fra tankesmien Civita.
Welcome to this talk, which will be both a podcast, Liberal halvtime, and an evening meeting, Civita kveld. My name is Mathilde Fasting, and today I'm joined by the historian Tom Holland. He has also his own podcast together with Dominic Sandbrook. The rest is history. And we're going to talk about a lot of things, including his last book, Dominion, The Making of the Western Mind. And this is not a small book, it's heavy. So
I'm afraid it is, yeah.
It's heavy.
It's a brick.
So welcome, Tom.
Thank you.
Nice to have you here in Oslo. I must say that I feel like talking to almost a kind of an encyclopedia today because you know so many things. It's challenging, but it's probably going to be very engaging and interesting. And remember, I'm not Dominic Sandbrook.
You are definitely not Dominic Sandbrook.
So
you have a lot more hair for a start.
That's a good thing. I'm probably not going to be so brutal.
No, I hope not.
No.
He's very rude.
He's rude. But no, he's not rude. But anyway, I know that you like to talk about Christianity and I know that you like cricket. But guess I don't know anything about cricket, but probably something about Christianity.
Christianity so it is then.
Then it is. So a good starting point for this conversation is year zero. Because we are today counting time with an explicit link to this year, the birth of Jesus. And according to this, to your last book, this is only the top of the iceberg when it comes to Christian influence in minds, morals, social norms, science, whatever, everything. So why do you believe Christianity became the winner?
Well, I think the idea that we are in the year 2021 and that is the 2021st year since the birth of Christ absolutely focuses the way in which Christianity continues to structure the way that we conceptualize the world, the way that we see it, in ways that we may not even think about. Because I'm sure that most people, I mean, I know I don't think, oh, it's 2021, and I immediately think, oh, well, since the birth of Jesus. But of course, it's there, it's lurking there. And that there are attempts now, people will say, BCE, before the Common Era. But I think that, that's not kidding anybody. It's
no.
the year remains
you can't just
the same.
Rebaptize
yes,
something.
Yes. And I think that that even the idea of the secular, the idea that somehow there is something called religion and that you can park it on one side, that even that idea is bred of Christianity. And I suppose I wrote the book really to explore the multiplicity of ways in which it's almost impossible for us, no matter how atheistical we may be, no matter how secular, no matter how aggressively anti-Christian or anti-religious we may be, we remain absolutely saturated in all kinds of ways with Christian assumptions.
Yes, and I also you also had just a lecture where you talked about how we count time, which is also a Christian kind of thinking.
Well, so I was talking. It was a talk with the perhaps provocative title: Does Jesus love dinosaurs? And of course, the how do dinosaurs fit into the Bible is it's been a notorious problem since the 19th century. But I guess what I was arguing in that was that ultimately the ability to discover, for instance, the vast depths of geological time, and to situate the fact of extinction, the fact that strange creatures that existed in the Mesozoic and no longer did, that requires an understanding of time that is linear rather than circular. Most civilizations have assumed that existence is punctuated by cycles of creation and destruction. Things just go round and round and round. But Christianity, like Judaism, like Islam, has this very distinct idea that time has a beginning, and particularly in Christianity, with the focus on revelation, on the end of days that is to come, that there is an end. And so therefore the habit of trying to think, we're in the present, there was a beginning, where are we to locate that beginning? That kind of depends on the Bible.
Yeah.
And so that's a kind of further example of the way in which even things that may seem to contradict the Bible, and I guess that, you know, vast expanses of geological time notoriously does seem to contradict Genesis, even so it's rooted in, again, in Christian assumptions.
Yes, and also the idea of progress, I think, because when we are thinking about this modern idea of of growth and things going in one direction and becoming better, that's probably also then a Christian idea. Without the end point.
So people often talk about Judeo-Christian values now. And I think that that is a bit of a... I think it obscures the way in which, for instance, actually Jews and Muslims have a lot more in common, say, than Christians do. And one of the obvious ways in which Jews and Muslims have something in common is that they have a very strong idea that of God as a lawgiver giving commands that are actually can be written down. So the most literal example of that is the stone tablets on which God has written that he gives to Moses. But you have the whole kind of structure of what becomes the Talmud, and in Islam, the equivalent, the Sunnah. In Christianity, we don't have that. In Christianity, Paul says that there is this second covenant in succession to the one that God had given the children of Israel on Sinai. And this second covenant is written on the heart. And this is such an alien concept to Jewish thought that Paul is forced to reach for a word that derives from the Stoics, who believed that the divine is manifest in everything and therefore within humans, and that this spark of the divine he calls the synodesis, which I guess we could call conscience. Mm. And so Paul says that this is where the law of God is written. And so the implication for Christian civilization is seismic, because it means that unlike in the Islamic world, there isn't this body of law that you can consult. You have to look into your heart to work it out. And so that therefore means that laws are going to be written by humans, but always with the prospect that the further you look into your heart, the more that you're animated by the Spirit, the more you approach a consciousness of God's purposes, so that law can improve. And so the idea that law should properly be progressive is something that is absolutely hardwired into our mind. And the existence of kind of progressivism in the modern West is absolutely a fruit of that. The idea that law can be improved all the time, and that that kind of is the business of government. I mean, you know, most people now entirely accept that without possibly thinking about the kind of incredibly theological roots of that.
Yeah, because you treat here in this book Paul as some kind of revolutionary, really. Completely. You're coming back to him all the time. So
I think he is... Yeah, I think putting aside, you know, the question of who Jesus was and what the sources are for Jesus, we know that Paul wrote at least 7 of the letters that are attributed to him in the New Testament, and they're not very long. I mean, you know, these are quite short letters, and yet they are the most, I think, the most transformative texts that we have from antiquity. I think in some ways you could say they're the most transformative texts that have ever been written. They are like kind of depth charge placed beneath the vast fabric of classical civilization. And it takes time for the ripple effects to be felt in the Roman world. But when they're felt, wow, are they felt? And the extraordinary thing is that the ripple effect from that depth charge continues to reverberate right the way into the present. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, again and again, when you start to think of things that we in the West may be tempted to assume are just, you know, just the way things are, just human nature, just the way that everybody is. And then you think, well, actually, is that the case? You know, if you look at the way things were in the past, in other ages, other places, you start to realize that wasn't the case at all. And then when you start to try and focus in on what's distinctive about, you know, the way that the West understands itself and structures itself, you think, well, where does it what's the starting point for this? Again and again you can trace it back to Paul.
I'm thinking about two words then, two things. The one thing is equality of selves, quality, and the other thing is universality. It's for everyone. So maybe you could elaborate a little bit on those two concepts.
Well, I think in a way that they kind of feed off each other. So the idea that every human being has an inherent dignity, which I think is, again, pretty much taken for granted by most people
today
in Western societies, as being self-evidently true. I mean, this was not self-evidently true to most people through most of time.
Not in the Roman times.
Absolutely not. But Paul, he's the heir to two traditions that kind of do hold this. So the Stoic one I just mentioned, I mean, that is a kind of theme in Greek philosophy that Paul does seem to have been heir to. But of course, he's a Jew, and so he's heir to the idea that all of humanity was created by the one God who created both men and women in his image. And so therefore, men and women have this incredible sense of dignity. And the Jewish understanding of humanity's relationship to a creator gives to human beings dignity far in excess of any other kind of ancient form understanding of humanity's purpose. But the Jews believe that they have a particular relationship with God, that they are his chosen people. And Paul upholds that. And he, of course, notoriously starts off as a persecutor of the church. And then he has this vision. And whether it was as described in Acts of the Apostles, which is written several decades, probably after his death, we don't know. But we know from Paul that he has this vision, he says, of the risen Christ. And this forces him to try and make sense of what this means, what's going on. And the amazing thing about the letters is that they're not statements of doctrine. They're incredibly dramatic attempts by someone to make sense of something that he doesn't entirely understand. But what he does come to see, as he sees it himself, is that there is a new covenant, and that this new covenant is for everybody. It's not just for the Jews. The covenant that God had established with the Jews holds. It's not like God is rejecting the Jews, but he is also offering this covenant for everybody. And so, as Paul famously says in his letter to the Galatians, there is no Jew or Greek, there is no man or woman, there is no slave or free in Christ. And so that in Christ slightly serves as a break on the radicalism of what Paul is asking. Mm-hmm. But the implications in the long run are, you know, I talked about these depth charges, because essentially Paul is saying that there is no difference of ethnicity or race. So, you know, if there's no Jew or Greek, there's no black or white, for instance, in modern terms. And there's no man or woman, then, you know, the kind of assumption of gender equality is kind of implicit as a kind of, you know, an acorn from which a great oak will grow. And there is no slave or free. Again, this kind of radical idea that perhaps institutional slavery is a problem. Now, nowhere in the Bible does it say that institutional slavery is an evil. And yet you can see in that idea that the dignity that all human beings share, and which this covenant that God is offering to everybody, that the kind of chain reaction which will culminate in abolitionism, and now in the 21st century with the deep-rooted assumption that, of course, slavery is an evil, and that we are licensed in the 21st century to sit in judgment on people from earlier ages who didn't recognize that. You know, that is basically where this comes from.
Mm. Yeah, because as you do in this book, you do stories, actually. You tell stories that are really interesting because they kind of pinpoint different things that you believe are important in these long 2,000 years history, more or less. Would you pick out some of them maybe and tell me about why you chose to do it that way?
Well, I guess two reasons. The first is that I think that a huge part of the power of Christianity's influence lies in narratives. I think that there are, you know, stories that Christians share with Jews, of which I think the Exodus story is the most important. The idea of a God who loves slaves rather than Pharaoh, and who saves them and gives them a promised land. And this has had an absolutely seismic influence on the way that Christians have understood their mission, whether it be in, you know, in for good, the sense of, you know, Martin Luther King strongly identifying himself with Moses, or for bad, you know,
lots of things,
you know, basically people saying, well, God has given us a promised land, let's go and get it. So I think that that's important. And then, of course, you have Jesus in the Gospels, who, among many other things, is the greatest short storyteller ever. Mm. I mean, you know, whether historical Jesus told these stories or whether they were invented by the gospel writers, these are amazing stories that
somebody did
right into the present day. If you think about the way that Angela Merkel responded to the influx of a million people from very, very different backgrounds by saying, okay, we'll let them in. It's inconceivable that she would have done that had she not been raised, you know, the daughter of a Lutheran pastor and be absolutely familiar with the parable of the Good Samaritan. So these stories are, I think, in many ways, vastly more influential than, say, you know, theology or doctrinal teachings. So I thought that it's important to have stories and narratives because, you know, that's a part of the kind of the way that Christianity has impacted. But also, it's a huge canvas. I mean, it's 2,500 years, and there's no way that I can cover everything. And so I thought, well, I'll break it down into Christian symbolic numerology. So there are, the kind of the two great sacred Christian numbers are 3 and 7. So you have the 3 for the Trinity,
yes,
and 7, the 7 deadly sins, the 7 virtues, 7 churches of Asia, you know, 7 sacraments, and so on like that. So I deliberately structured it that there would be 3 sections, each of 7 chapters, each chapter with 3 parts, and each chapter opens with a particular kind of a story, a particular moment in history that perhaps will serve as a kind of launching pad for the particular field or theme that I study in that chapter.
That's absolutely.
And I wanted some of them to be familiar and some of them not to be familiar.
Yeah, that's true, because some of them I knew about and some of them I didn't, but it was coming all to senses by reading through the chapters. So I'll just have to say to the listeners, you have to read it.
Well, it's got some quiet ones. So it's got Martin Luther, for instance, burning the papal bull. It's got the Beatles in Abbey Road. So these are, you know, quite, everyone will have some sense of them. But then there's also kind of amazing, I think the most amazing story is at the beginning of the 14th century, a group of nuns who subscribed to this astonishing heresy that the Holy Spirit has been incarnate in a woman, that an age is approaching where the age of the sun will fade and the age of the Spirit will dawn. The Pope will become a woman, the cardinals will become a woman. And obviously, the inquisitors don't really approve of this. So the nun herself gets burned and the body of the supposed incarnation of the Holy Spirit gets dug up and burned.
Because also I've read another book about also someone has written a book about inventing the individual. That was
Larry Seedentop.
Yes, yeah. It is. So you probably know that book.
Absolutely,
as well.
Yes. It was a reassurance to me to read that I was on the right lines with.
Yes, I was about to say the same, because he talks a lot about loss, and maybe you could say something about that, and when we can come into how for instance, secularism came about, because that's also a very interesting story.
So loss, specifically.
First, well, loss, as you started out by mentioning the difference between Muslim and or Islam laws and how they, and also Judaism, and how that came to be developing through the centuries. And because that's...
I think that if you're told to look into your heart and discover the law of God there, it's kind of inherently unstable.
Yeah.
And so you have within Christianity, which of course you have in all traditions, but I think it's particularly finely balanced in Christianity, this tension between a sense of the inheritance from the past, so the Hebrew scriptures, the Gospels, corpus of texts come the New Testament, and then in time the teachings of the church fathers, and then the liturgies and so on, that structure the church and enables the church to have a sense of continuity. But at the same time, if you're looking into the heart and waiting for the Spirit to illuminate your understanding of God's purposes, then there's a chance that you may come to see this inheritance from the past as something to be jettisoned. Mm. And in a sense, that's the tension that's always been there in Christianity, and it's why it's prone to kind of evolving in often quite startling ways. And I think that in the West particularly, so Latin Christendom, the Latin-speaking church that's separate from the Orthodox church that remains centered in Constantinople, in the 11th century, you have this kind of great process of revolution. It's really Europe's first revolution, and it's so successful that we tend not to remember it because it's the, it's the partial revolutions that we remember, but the successful ones we don't because we just take on board. And essentially, what happens in the 11th century is that various radicals seize control of the bishopric of Rome and transform it into what we now understand of as the medieval papacy. This kind of sovereign, the Church of Rome as the Latin Church is something sovereign that stands outside the fabric of the kingdoms, the earthly kingdoms, and that kings and emperors should have no part of this, and that their kind of grubby fingers have to be prized away from it. And the motivation for this is a desire to kind of render in the form of geopolitics what an individual goes through with baptism, that you were cleansed and born anew and purified. And that impulse has a seismic impact. It kind of reverberates through the Middle Ages, which is the first great kind of revolutionary period in European history. Medieval Latin Christendom is a profoundly revolutionary order. It's not at all backward. It's absolutely revolutionary. And it establishes the paradigm for everything that follows. Because what you get in the Protestant Reformation, what you get in the Enlightenment, what you get in the French Revolution, what you get in the Russian Revolution, and what I would say we're getting now with the 60s, and the aftermath of that, is this kind of cycle of what the initial reformers in the 11th century had, that Christendom is stained by sin, that we need to, you know, be born again, we need to be baptized into the Spirit, we need to wash the Christian people clean of their sins. That's a massive, massive impulse that is constantly kicking against the inheritance of what we've received. So the revolutionaries in the 11th century are kicking against the early medieval church. The Protestant reformers are kicking against the Roman church. The Enlightenment is kicking against the idea of Christianity, full stop. And now we're kind of into a stage where, you know, reformers are kicking against the whole idea of the West. So it's a process that kind of ends up consuming the inheritance of the past while remaining absolutely true to that inheritance while as it does so, which is the kind of great paradox at the heart of Western culture, I think.
Yes, so because you wrote before we had this talk, you wrote about saying that we are in the midst of a new Reformation.
I think so,
yes,
yeah.
And time will judge if the 1960s it is really a period of transformation, or if it's not, we don't know that as
I think
as
we
by
do.
Now.
I would say we do.
So where will it go? Where will it lead to?
That I don't know, but I do think that the 1960s will come to be seen as a period of dislocation and rebirth and convulsion of an order comparable to the 1520s. Which is the decade that launches the Reformation in Europe. And just as it took time for people in the 16th century to kind of recognize that they had lived through something called the Reformation. I mean, I think it wasn't until the 1580s or 90s that people start to see, you know, to look back and to kind of see it as, in that kind of way. I think that for us, it's too early actually to comprehend where it's going and what the end results might be. But I do think that we've lived through a period of unbelievably rapid moral and ethical change. And yet, as I say, fueled by assumptions that are absolutely rooted in the deep Christian past.
Yes, and that brings me over to the other thing, the secularism. And I think it's really interesting to read how you see that also as something also deeply rooted in Christendom, so that you have to explain.
So this is an absolutely classic example of how difficult it is. It's kind of like Christianity is like a kind of tar pit, you know, these tar pits that you had in California where mastodons or whatever would wander in. And then the more they struggled to get out of it, the more they'd sink in. So one of the reasons why I wanted to write Dominion, why I came to write Dominion, was that I was writing about classical antiquity. And again, I found writing in English, a language saturated in Christian assumptions, that there were certain words that just felt completely anachronistic when applied to the pre-Christian classical world. So to use the word secular about ancient Rome, say, it felt to me as anachronistic as saying that Julius Caesar conquered France. You could kind of see what I'd mean, but immediately, it doesn't sound right. And so I was kind of wanted to explore why that was. And basically, the reason is that the idea of the secular and the idea of religion and that these are separate categories are themselves deeply rooted in Christian theology. And I guess the ultimate, you know, the ultimate source for this is the famous story in the Gospels of Jesus being asked, should we pay taxes to the Romans? And Jesus saying, do you have a coin? And being given the coin and saying, whose head is on the coin? And they answer Caesar, and he says, well, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and render unto God what is God's, setting up this kind of idea that there's a tension between the heavenly order and the earthly order. And that gets massively refined and consolidated by Augustine in the 5th century in the aftermath of the sack of Rome, where lots of non-Christians say, well, look, you see where Christianity has led us. The eternal city has been humiliated. And Augustine turns around and says, no, because Rome is nothing. It's earthly. It belongs to what he calls the order of the secularium. And the saeculum is the span of living human memory.
Yes.
And for Augustine, it comes to mean basically the flux of things, the sense that human beings are born, live, and die, and essentially they are leaves born on a kind of great river that flows and flows and flows, and that there is no redemption from this flow of the saeculum except through the bond that the church provides to God. And the Latin for bond is religio. And a religio is a bond that you establish with a god, perhaps by a sacrifice, perhaps by a priesthood or a festival or something like that. So Augustine says that it's this. There is now only the one religio. The Roman, you know, the pagans had loads of religiones, but the church, there is only the one God, and so there is only the one religio. And so he sets up this counterpoint between the dimension of the saeculum and the dimension of religio. And in the 11th century, this gets massively radicalized because the reformers basically are saying to kings and to earthly potentates, you know, your power belongs to the saeculum. It's the religio that the church has that offers redemption. And over the course of the Middle Ages, and then particularly into the Reformation, this comes to harden. And this sense that there are kind of twin dimensions just becomes part of the mental furniture of people. And when, you know, the Latin words start to be adapted by the vernacular languages of modern Europe, this sense kind of gets embedded within each language. So in English, the idea that you have the secular and the idea that you have religion beds down. And because in English, the majority are Protestant, you have this idea that religio, which in the Middle Ages had been particularly associated with specialists in religio, so monks or nuns or hermits or whatever. But in Protestantism, everyone has religio. Everyone has a bond with God. And so this idea of religion as something that you as an individual believe in fuses with the idea of religion as something that is separate from the secular to basically construct the model of religion that we have now, and that the Western powers over the colonial period then exported and basically kind of imposed on, you know, other regions of the world, so that we now talk of Islam or Hinduism or Buddhism as religions. And because English is the lingua franca, say in India, Hindus now think of themselves as belonging to a religion. And that is something that I think we see now in India. We see a massive kickback against it, because essentially that's what Modi is against. The whole idea of Hindutva is that Hinduism isn't a religion, that what we call Hinduism is actually the essence of what it is to be an Indian. It saturates everything. And that's an attempt to get back to a kind of pre-secular, pre-British, pre-Christian understanding. And you see the same thing in Turkey. I said that's absolutely what Erdogan is doing as well, because the secularism that Ataturk brought in was very, very self-consciously modeled, you know, derived from kind of European models, and so ultimately Christian models. And Erdogan, as a devout Muslim, I mean, that's what he's reacting against. Mm. That's why he's turned, you know, Hagia Sophia, the great Byzantine cathedral that got turned into a mosque, Ataturk turned it into a museum, secular space. And Erdogan has now turned it back into a mosque.
So, but let's talk about the origins of human rights.
Right. Yes, again.
Go again.
Yes.
Where do we start? Well,
you see, so I guess I wrote Dominion as a liberal who had come to lose his faith, because I wrote a book about the origins of Islam, in which basically I ended up questioning a lot about what Muslims believe about the life of Muhammad and the origins of the Quran. And I gave a talk, and I remember a Muslim in the audience saying, you know, why you've done this? You'd never do this to your own beliefs. But the truth was that I was starting to do that to my own beliefs, because I was starting, you know, I kind of identified myself with enlightenment values and with human rights and all this kind of stuff. And I was already coming to question that. And human rights is a kind of classic example of something that it's very easy to assume. People talk about universal human rights.
Yes,
that they, you know, that they apply across the board. That they somehow exist. That they kind of, you know, they're out there.
But
of course they're not.
Yeah,
this is a fantastical idea. And so when I said, well, you know, where does this idea come from? It goes back again to this incredibly momentous period of ideological and political ferment in the 11th and 12th centuries. And one of the things that this period of convulsion in the 11th and 12th century generates are institutions in which a framework of law can be fashioned that will structure this sovereign entity that the church is kind of willing itself into becoming. And these institutions are called universities.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea of the universal is kind of embedded in the very word. And one of the great projects that gets undertaken in these universities is an attempt to work out, well, what is the proper basis for this law that is written on the heart? And they look at, you know, the teachings of Jesus, and it's evident from the teachings of Jesus that the rich have a responsibility of care to the poor. And they extrapolate the obvious implication of this, that, well, if that's the case, then the poor have a right to what the rich give them. And essentially, it's from that that the idea that human beings have rights to dignity, to shelter, to food, to whatever, really starts to kind of put down its roots. So it's an incredibly culturally contingent concept. And again, we've been kind of privileged in the West because we've been so powerful. We've been so hegemonic that we've been able to assume that the way we see the world is somehow can be equated to humanity generally. So the kind of arrogance of saying that this very culturally contingent concept is universal is something that is only now starting really, I think, to be called out. You know, and obviously if you believe in human rights, this is a challenge because to believe in them requires at least, you know, a leap of faith as believing that Jesus rose from the dead and sits enthroned in glory at the right hand of his Father. I mean, they're both inherently fantastical beliefs that aren't at all self-evident.
I know also that we are jumping a little bit here, but you talked to Francis Fukuyama a while ago.
Yeah.
And also,
having read your series of interviews,
yes,
which I see is directly behind you. My copy is very heavily annotated, noted,
absolutely.
And lined.
just like this one. Anyway, he, of course, has this idea of liberal democracy. And also when you're talking about human rights, about democracy, about liberal democracies, and also the West, that is a Western phenomenon also from the beginning. But by your statement, he says he believes in liberal democracies, and you had like something that I sensed was a small question mark behind his title, The End of History. What do you think about liberal democracies here? And maybe if you expand that again from Christianity, I guess you would. But
well,
democracy, though...
I don't need to tell you that end of history...
is just a concept.
It's the telos.
Yes.
It's the thing to which we are moving towards. Which, of course... I mean, Fukuyama is from ultimately a kind of Protestant background.
Yes, he is.
And so I think that the idea that, you know, again, that time, history has an endpoint, you know, that there is a kind of goal towards which it moves is, you know, and it's there in Marx, it's there in Hegel, and they likewise are getting it from, you know, it's an assumption that derives from the Christian context,
yes,
in which they come. I mean, that's not to say that it's directly drawn from it, but it is part of, you know, if you were, I mean, I imagine if, you know, the world, say, were Buddhist, that sense that history has an end would not be as obvious. Mm. And so I think that... I think it's expressive of a particular Western way of conceptualizing the world. I mean, that's not to say that maybe it will triumph. I mean, the West has obviously been the most seductive and convincing way of explaining how things work that's ever existed. But I do think that as our as the West's kind of political, economic, military power recedes, I think the likelihood is that its kind of cultural assumptions will start to recede as well, which again is kind of what you see in India, what you see in Turkey, certainly what you see in China.
Yeah, because his point is also, of course, that the end of history is an expression for saying that so far, if you are thinking about, again, human rights, dignity of humans, and also of political systems where everybody can be a member of a democracy with voting rights and everything, it's all Christian, as we have discovered right now. He says that this is probably, at least to his mind, the best political system that humanity, that we have been able to invent. So he says, yeah, as long as people can't come up with any other system that might be even better, and then respecting all these things, which again, as you say, human rights are not universal, they are embedded in Christianity, but also the dignity and respect between people that you don't find, for instance, in China, but that you find economic growth, you find all the other things, but you don't find people going for vote and changing their leaders and everything. So that's his point, really.
Yeah, I mean, I think that obviously there is a problem that that Christians have always faced, which liberal democracy exists as an attempt to solve, and that is that you can preach the universal dignity of human beings, but what do you do with people who reject that?
Yeah,
and that's the problem for Paul, right? So right, it's there right from the beginning. So when he says there is no Jew or Greek, you know, there are lots of
a
majority of Jews who don't want to have their difference dissolved into a kind of universalism and reject it, and so the relationship of Christianity to the Jews, you know, that's been a massive shadow over the supposedly, you know, the claim that all human beings have an inherent dignity, because that was absolutely not the experience of Jews for most of Christian history. Nor was it the experience of Muslims or pagans or heretics or whatever. So that's always been a problem. And of course, in the Reformation, when you have the Catholics and Protestants tearing great chunks out of each other, liberalism emerges as an attempt to kind of maintain that sense of a dignity that all human beings contain, that's kind of emancipated itself from the kind of doctrinal insistence of Catholics or Protestants. But that attempt exists still, I think, within the kind of assumptions of Christian universalism. and the assumption that every individual matters. And of course, if you were raised in a kind of Christian context, then you're going to take for granted that those are positives. I don't think that the history of the 21st century implies that everybody necessarily accepts those as givens. And I think it's kind of difficult for us in the West to recognize that things that we might be tempted to assume are so obvious and so fundamental that they just are, actually are just very culturally contingent.
It's just like the other book that I read some time ago called Weird. It's about psychology, yes, and the changing of the brain, actually. That's the person, or the he is saying that, okay, this is not only cultural, this is going on, and it's inside, it's changed our way of mapping things
in
the West.
I think that's absolutely true. And he fixes on the way that the church councils over the course of the Middle Ages attempted to define the character of incest.
Yes, and family patterns.
Yes. And that's an absolutely kind of classic example of how deeply rooted theological concerns ripple outwards and kind of completely change the fabric of society, and therefore, by extension, change the way that we who are born into that society then see the world. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of amazing.
Because it's actually also proved by psychology when you're testing people how they see things, and you can see that you could do that in populations of Western people and then in China, for instance, and you would see that there's a difference. But anyway, let's go to China then, because China is also a puzzle for Fukuyama. And how do you see China and the making of the Chinese mind? This is the making of the Western mind.
I have to admit that, you know, I claim
great
insight at all into China.
But you acknowledge that they're
different. I have a section in... the only place where China really appears in Dominion is... it's a section on the Jesuits who, in the 17th century, go to Beijing. And they are welcomed there, not for the Christian message that they are bringing, but because they have a greater ability to work out when eclipses are going to happen. And this is incredibly important.
So mathematics.
Yes.
Astrology.
Yes. Well,
astronomy, sorry.
Well,
yeah.
This matters to the Chinese because they have to predict eclipses so that measures can be taken to avert the sinister portents that these eclipses seem to be portending. And the Jesuits can calculate this more efficiently. And they can calculate this more efficiently because they have an understanding of the cosmos that enables them to recognize it as being governed by laws. So they see the cosmos as a kind of entirety that's been fashioned by a single creator who structures it with laws. And it's that understanding that then underpins the breakthroughs and the developments in astronomy that enable the Jesuits to apply this to the motion of the stars. What's interesting is that the only way that Chinese mandarins can absorb this understanding seems to be by becoming themselves Christian. So this framework for what in the long run will come to be called science, it seems to be so rooted in a Christian understanding of the universe that you actually have to convert in the 17th century Chinese court to kind of be able to work it out. So I think in the long run, the fact that scientific revolution comes to be accepted in China, I mean, it does serve to kind of, in a very faint way, Christianize it. And I suppose the other way in which China's been Christianized is that it is ostensibly a Marxist society. Mm. And the assumptions of Marx are deeply rooted in ideas of the apocalypse, ideas of the last shall be first and the first shall be last. The idea that a day of judgment will come when sheep and goats will be divided into two. I mean, all of this is absolutely... Marx's writings are absolutely saturated in these assumptions. So to an element, that also is a part of China. But China is, it's just incredibly different.
Yes.
Incredibly, incredibly different in ways I couldn't begin to fathom. I just know that when I look at it, that it's very, very different. And it's a kind of standing reproach to our assumption that what we believe is just human nature.
Yes. And then what about then us living in more and more plural societies with lots of people believing in different things, and how can we Christianity has, well, for many centuries been like gluing things together. It's not anymore.
Yeah, well,
how do you see that?
Well,
so is there anything to us?
I think
idea?
That is a challenge. And I think that what I was saying about the secular,
yes,
essentially providing a kind of framework of assumptions that people in the West take for granted, that the experience, say, of Muslims in Europe contradicts that. Because for Muslims, it's not at all given that there's such a thing as religion and the secular, church and state. I mean, it's telling that we call it church and state, not mosque and state. And the experience of Muslims since the war in Europe is very analogous to the experience of Jews in the 19th century, because up until the 19th century, the Jews had no sense of themselves as belonging to a religion or belonging to something called Judaism. Judaism was a Christian coinage.
Yes.
It's in the 19th century with the French Revolution, the aftermath of the French Revolution, where everybody in the French Republic is offered citizenship. Doesn't matter what your religion is, Catholic, Protestant, Jewish, but you have to accept that your primary loyalty is to the French state. Whereas previously Jews had belonged, you know, they were the people of Israel. They were the nation of Israel. They had to give that up. And they were allowed to be citizens of France, but they had to accept that their Jewishness was the expression of a religion. Mm. And so both Reform Judaism and Orthodox Judaism, which emerges in the 19th century, is an attempt to respond to that. And you know, we know the kind of the complications and horrors that emerge from the attempt of the attempt that Jews have to make to adapt to this fundamentally kind of Christian understanding of society. And I think that Muslims now are going through a very similar process, because they have freedom of religion, but it obliges Muslims to see themselves as belonging to a religion and not as they had previously done, you know, right the way up until, you know, essentially Napoleon goes crashing into Egypt. They just took for granted that, you know, that they are an ummah, they are a people. That's what it is to be a Muslim. And that Islam isn't a religion. Islam is just, you know, it's kind of the air you breathe. It's just the way things are. You don't have to define it beyond that. Whereas now it's a much more attenuated thing. Islam is something that, you know, like a Protestant, it's what you believe, it's what you do in private. But you shouldn't be allowed to intrude on the public space. And I think that most Muslims actually in Europe are pretty happy with that. I mean, I think that they are becoming incredibly Protestantized. I think modern Islam really is a very Protestantized religion. It's become something very, very different since the 18th century. But obviously there are lots of Muslims who really recognize that and really resent it. And part of the appeal of, you know, the Islamic State was precisely that it wasn't a religion, it was a state. And it offered Muslims in Europe the chance to go and live a life in which Islam isn't a religion, it's something more. You know, the expression of that was kind of hideous by our lights, but it obviously answered a kind of emotional appeal, something deep within Muslims in Europe, kind of recognition that something's been lost by the process of having to fit into a secular society.
But it's becoming more and more difficult to obtain that kind of society, I think.
I'm not sure. I think it has an incredible weathering effect. I think that secularism, it's not just that it's kind of bedded down. It transforms the way that everybody sees society, and it transforms the way that, you know, it persuades people that they belong to things called religions. And, you know, that's fine for Christians because, you know, it emerges from Christianity, so it's easy for them. But I think for Jews, for Muslims, for Sikhs, for whoever, I think that they're becoming massively secularized and therefore to that extent becoming Christianized.
Yeah, so then I think that we have almost now covered the Western mind, not in detail, but a little bit.
We have 40 minutes?
Scratching about little. Anything we missed out? Because this is really, I mean, dominion means that we are dominating.
Yeah, and that's the core paradox,
the heart
of Christianity, because the symbol of Christianity, of course, is...
We haven't talked about crucifixion yet.
A symbol of torture,
yeah,
on which a rebel against Roman power, you know, against earthly power, is tortured to death. And so the implication of that is that it's better to be a slave than a master, to be tortured than a torturer, to die than to execute.
In your descriptions here, it doesn't seem like it.
But that's kind of the point, isn't it? I mean, it's unspeakably horrible. But the cross has become emblematic of the most hegemonic way of explaining humanity's purpose that's ever existed. And so that tension between the identification of Christianity with powerlessness as being close to God and the fact that it's become so powerful is the source of incredible tension.
So what you actually have done here is explaining to us all how much Christianity goes into everything that we might not in everyday think about as Christian, but it is actually when you're going into all the details here and look at it, how it's become almost, it is internalized.
Yeah, internalized.
So even though you cannot say that you're not Christian, but in a way you are if you're born in the West, is that right?
I think so, yeah. And I think that's true of, you know, as we were saying, I think it's true to a degree of whether you are an atheist, whether you're an agnostic, whether you're a Jew, whether you're a Muslim. The metaphor that I would use, and it came to me after I'd finished that, I watched, I don't know whether it's been shown in Norway, but there was a TV drama about Chernobyl.
Yeah.
And there was a scene in that where two people are right up next to the reactor, and you can see the radioactivity leaking out because it's ionizing the air, so you can see the physical effects of it. You're up close, there's no question what's happening, you know what's happening. But the impact of Chernobyl, of course, is that that radioactivity then spreads across the forests of Ukraine, across Kiev, up into Scandinavia, so up here. And you're breathing it in, you don't see it, but it's changing you and affecting you. And that's what I think the effect of Christianity is. You don't have to be aware of it to be changed by it. So
that's it then, Tom.
That's it, yeah.
Thanks a lot for coming, and thanks a lot for sharing all these thoughts in 40 minutes. Probably you don't use 40 minutes to read this. You have to use a couple of hours, I guess. Yes, a bit longer. But thanks a lot for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Liberal halvtime. En podcast fra tankesmien Civita.